So I talk about this in a second. You have a torus in each fiber, and then you have, once you are talking about an elliptic curve, you can pick a symplectic basis of your homology, and then you can talk about the periods in each fiber. And then you try to construct an antiderivative for these periods, and these will enter in the low energy description of the effective Lagrangian. Tell you exactly in a little bit what the quantities are. Okay, so one thing about elliptic vibrations is that if you try to construct a smooth elliptic vibration over CP1, you can just compute that it's trivial if you only have regular fibers. So you need to have some singular fibers in this elliptic vibration, and that was the second kind of ingenious assumption Seibeck and Witten made, that they said that the points in the moduli space where some of the BPS states become massless, exactly correspond to the singularities of the elliptic vibration. So now you can ask, okay, if I have this fiber over each U, I tell you what G2 and G3 is, how do I recognize whether this fiber is smooth or singular? You can check this by computing the discriminant of the fiber. And so the discriminant is computed from this G2 and the G3. And as long as this is not equal to zero, your fiber is smooth. So now we know, in order to have some interesting moduli space, we actually have to have singular fibers in that space. Fortunately, in such a setting, an elliptic vibration over a one-dimensional complex space, the possible singular fibers were completely classified by Kodaira in the 1950s. And he could exactly tell you what kind of possible singular fibers you can have. But then, from the weak coupling limit of the theory, which is described as U approaches infinity, we know that we can only have certain singularities. So in the weak coupling limit, we must have a singular fiber of type, in the Kodaira classification, 1 I star 4 minus NF. And let me just tell you what this means in terms of G2, G3, and delta. It means that G2 has a 0 of order 2. G3 has a 0 of order 3. And delta has a 0 of order 6. Okay, so it's 10 minus NF, sorry. And so you have the singularity at the fiber at infinity. Why you have to have this particular structure at infinity, I'll explain in a second. But then you can resolve this singularity. And the point is, Kodaira tells you exactly what kind of structure you obtain. Yeah?
I'm a bit confused. So you told us that delta is that polynomial.
What?
Delta is equal to g2q minus 27 g3 squared.
Yeah.
On the formula on top there.
Yeah.
Yeah, so how do you get the 10 minus an f if g2 is...
Okay, I should have said this. So take the case nf equals 0, then the discriminant in this coordinate picture is the famous u squared minus 1, which appeared in the paper of Seibeck and Witten. But now we are trying to investigate the point u at infinity. So we have to change variables. U equals 1 over v. You go to the other coordinate chart of the sphere, but then you have to transform the discriminant. And how does the discriminant transform? It transforms like this, v to the 12, and then you replace u with 1 over v. So you get 1 over v squared minus 1. So there you see you get v to the 10 minus v to the 12, and at v equals 0, it vanishes at the order 10. So I should have said this, once you change the coordinate chart from this chart to the other chart, of course these sections, delta g2 and g3, are sections over the u-plane, and you have to transform these sections accordingly.
So is that formula valid? Okay, so it's only valid for nf equals to 0.
No, this formula is generally valid.
That has at least 6 zeros, right? Okay.
So I just thought, if I give you the simplest example, you would see my point. I think what puzzled me in the beginning is that these are really sections, and you have to transform them if you go from one chart to the other. So and now you can do something. You can write down. For each nf, the possible configurations of singular fibers. And then we'll have a singular fiber at infinity whose structure we can determine from the recoupling limit. And then the question is, what are the configuration of singular fibers I have to write down for finite u? And now you can make a big list, and let me just give you an excerpt from this list. So in the nf equals 0 case, what you have to have is you have to add two more singular fibers for finite u, and these singularities of type I1, they are nodes. So think of the torus, and now you are making one of the cycles of the torus shrink. So here you have a torus, and now I make one of the cycles shrink, so you get a node, and that's exactly the kind of singularity this I1 says. Then in the case nf equals 1, you have to have three singular fibers of type I1. And then as you go to higher NFs, there are more possibilities of combinations and configurations of singular fibers. So let me only give you one example for each, and then I later on explain why I specifically picked these examples. So here you can add singular fibers of this type I2, and here you can add singular fibers of type I4 and I1. And what does it mean? A singular fiber of type IK means that G2 and G3 are not zero at this point, but delta vanishes at order k. And again, this information using Kodaira's classification result tells you exactly how you have to resolve this singularity. All right, so now let's talk about these examples a little bit. So the ones which Seiberg and Witten considered in the beginning was this one and this one, because they have very nice properties. So this example is also known as the universal curve of H over gamma 0,4. So what does that mean? This H means the upper half plane in the complex plane, and I'm dividing by this congruent subgroup of SL2Z, whose matrices are lower diagonal modular 4. That's what this gamma 0,4 means. So for each tau in here, what is the fiber of this elliptic vibration? It's the elliptic curve with modular parameter tau. So if you have such a nice description that instead of u, you can also use a description of the upper half plane divided by modular subgroup, such an object is called a modular elliptic surface. Not every elliptic surface is a modular elliptic surface, but among the elliptic surfaces, these modular ones are the particularly nice ones. And similarly, the case for NF equals 2 can be obtained as dividing H by gamma 2, the group of matrices in SL2Z, which are the unit matrix modular 2. And so these are very closely related by something which is called 2 isogeny. And what that means is essentially that the tau parameter here is half the tau parameter there. So if you can describe this elliptic curve, you can also describe this elliptic curve. And so originally, I think in their original paper, Seiberg and Witten started with this curve, but then kind of switched to this curve. In any case, these two are very easy to describe. And now if you look at the third case here, it looks very, very much like the first case, except that we have transferred the star from this I4 star singularity to an I1 singularity. And this operation of transferring the star, it's really, this is what the geometers call it, transferring the star, is something you can control very well. So if you know this elliptic vibration, it's very easy to understand this elliptic vibration by this operation of which is called transferring the star. And last, we have this case for NF equals to 1. And I should point out that this case is not an elliptic modular surface. In fact, these three I wrote down are the only elliptic modular surfaces which appear as Seiberg-Witten curves in the setting of gauge theory with gauge group SU2 or SO3. But you should remember what I said initially, that this list is much longer. I only picked certain cases out of this long list, and I want to explain to you now why I picked these cases. The physical explanation is the following. In the beginning I said that I also want to include hypermultiplets. So if I include hypermultiplets, I can talk about the bare mass of these hypermultiplets. And these curves describe the moduli space of the theories where I have set the bare masses of these hypermultiplets to zero, which will make our life a lot easier. And then I'll explain in a second what changes if we give them a bare mass. All right, so...
Is there any for this one to the other door is closed? Sorry, I need to drop something.
Yeah, just go ahead. All right, so that was the...
Can you remind me what this tar does?
So I gave you a description in terms of the singularity, and I also told you how you have to transform sections when you go from one shard to the other. What transferring of the star means is essentially you are multiplying G2 and G3 through with a polynomial as if you would change coordinate shards, but only of half the degrees. So you can, I think the easiest at this stage is just to go from the definition which I gave to you. I told you each singularity corresponds to a certain behavior of G2, G3 and delta, and once you have a representative for this curve, you can easily get a representative for this curve by multiplying through with some polynomials. I can show that to you if you're really interested. Alright, so and in addition, Seebeck and Witten introduced a holomorphic 2 form, let's call it eta, which is the following form. Remember, I gave you, these are the coordinates of the fiber, the Weierstrass coordinate, and this is holomorphic 2 form, which if you exclude the singular locus, doesn't vanish anywhere. And in math, if you give this sort of structure together with this sort of holomorphic 2 form, it's called an analytically marked elliptic fibration. And what do we use this for? And that comes back to your question of what the coordinates on the fiber are. We can, now that we have an elliptic curve in each fiber, we can pick in each regular fiber, we can pick a symplectic basis, an A cycle and a B cycle, and then we can integrate this form over the A cycle and the B cycle. And the result of this integration are called the periods. For the A cycle, this is usually denoted by omega. And for the B cycle, this is denoted by omega prime, such that tau equals omega prime over omega. And this tau is what appears at the complexified gauge coupling in the description of the gauge theory. And now, if you have, remember we now have the U-plane with its singular points, and the fiber is going to be a torus. Here it's going to be a nodal torus, and so on. Now you can ask, what happens to these periods as you go around the singular fibers? And it turns out, from the construction, as you go around the singular fibers, they transform by a duality transformation, an element, in these cases where I have an elliptic modular surface, an element of these congruent subgroups. And so if you go around the singular fiber at infinity, the behavior of what kind of transformation I get at infinity is exactly given to you by the singular fiber at infinity, and it turns out that infinity tau transforms into tau plus 4 minus nf. And this is what where it comes from when I said in the beginning that the weak coupling limit determines what kind of singularity you should have at infinity, because I think how it went historically is that people knew about this duality transformation and used that to fix the singular fiber at infinity, and then went from there to determine what the whole elliptic vibration looks like. All right, so now that we have fixed this analytical marking, we can actually do some very nice geometry on this elliptic vibration, which is called special Kähler geometry. And it just repeats nicely some of the steps you often do in classical mechanics. So what can we do? We can take this two-form eta and wedge it with its complex conjugate, and then integrate over the fiber. And then we get a Kähler form, and I want to write this Kähler form in its canonical coordinates. I want to write it as tp wedge dq, and then if my notation works out correctly, I think dp should be the real part of omega du, and dq should be the real part of omega prime du. Okay, so now we have a symplectic two-form, and now we can define a symplectic connection. So we can define a connection now by saying that the dual of the form dp, which is the derivative with respect to p, that the covariant derivative of this vanishes, and the same for q, and then to have a compatibility condition with the complex structure, you also have to ask for, so if I take an arbitrary vector field, remember these, in principle I can have complex vector fields over each fiber, I ask that when I take the projection onto the 1,0 part, that this endomorphism, if I take the exterior derivative of on the form part and the covariant derivative on the endomorphism part, that this is equal to 0. So this is essentially a compatibility condition between the connection and the complex structure. And from this construction, it's clear that the covariant derivative of the symplectic form is 0, and such a connection is called a special Kähler connection. I quickly have to check my notation. All right, and now you can already write down what the locally constant vector fields are.
Sorry, can I ask something?
Yeah, of course.
So, if you just wanted to define a Kähler connection in this way, what condition would you pass on?
I mean,
I'm
the
okay.
So this is not the Levi-Civita connection. So it's not compatible with the metric which you get from the Kähler form. So so like if you want to define the Kähler connection, you start differently. You want to have you first construct the Levi-Civita connection and then check that it's compatible. So in this example, I should say this, you can also define, compute the Levi-Civita connection. And they are related by interesting quantities. But there's this very nice paper by Dan Fried where he talks about special Kähler geometry. And I think in there he computes everything you can possibly compute. Alright, so now we can write down what the locally constant vector fields are. So the locally constant vector fields, let's say real vector fields, can be written down as, you know, we just put some constants in front of dp and dq, and later on, of course, this nm and this ne will become the magnetic and electric charge. But right now, they are just real constants. There's no reason for them to be integers, even. All right, so let me come back to this one question you asked earlier on, which is, what kind of the data do we need to describe the low-energy effective field theory? And I think Seibeck and Witten did this, also Mu and Witten did this. If you want to describe the n equals 2 low-energy effective field theory, to describe the Lagrangian, you need two quantities from this vibration. You need this tau parameter as function of u, and the other quantity you need to describe the Lagrangian also comes out very nicely from this special Kähler geometry. It's the cubic holomorphic form, which measures how compatible the connection with the projection on the 1-0 part is. I just wanted to point out these two things are different quantities here. So this thing is always zero because I'm applying the exterior derivative on the form part and the covariant derivative on the endomorphism part. And here I just understand this as applying the covariant derivative on the endomorphism part. So this is the reason why this is not zero. Okay, and so if you now want to try to write down the low energy effective Lagrangian, you'll see all the couplings in front of the terms which appear in this Lagrangian are determined by these two quantities, which have a very nice interpretation as the modular parameter and the cubic holomorphic 3 form of this special Kähler geometry. All right, so what do we want to do now? Then the question is,
one question.
Yeah.
So in this class, so near infinity, what's the cubic form?
Do you want me to write it down in terms of the prepotential?
Just have some intuition of what it is in semi-classical domain.
I mean, this would in local coordinates, that would be exactly
so
what it is.
The contour of some kinetic terms for the scalar.
Exactly.
Okay, good.
Wait, I'm not quite sure. That's the coefficient here which appears in front of this term of the, I think there's a term like this, which appears in the low energy Lagrangian. And this is where the cubic holomorphic 3 form comes in. All right, so then what you try to do is to actually understand whether these local coordinates I wrote down are globally well defined. So you ask the question, can I write omega as the derivative of a function A and omega prime as the derivative of a function, holomorphic function, which is usually denoted by AD. And of course, on a small open set, you can always locally do that. But of course, the question is, what happens when we go around a singularity? We know that how the periods transform, but the question is, how do these functions AD and A transform? And in general, they do not transform as nicely as the periods. In general, you get some constant term here when you go around the singularity, which would mess up a global definition of your AD and A. So let's think about this a little bit more from the point of view of the holomorphic two form I mentioned to you earlier, which we used to actually obtain the periods. So what we are asking is, if we have this two form omega, du wedge dx over y, can we find a one form? And I think the one form is usually called lambda psi by Witten, so that the exterior derivative of this lambda is the form omega. And the answer is, you can always do that, but you actually have to pay a price. This lambda psi by Witten is usually only meromorphic, but you know that the singular locus, so it has some sort of singular locus, but it always has constant residues around the singular locus. And these residues are exactly what give you this constant C when you go around the singularities. So now you can ask a question. I gave you the list of all the possible psi by Witten curves, and then you can ask, okay, I've written this form omega, I can construct this meromorphic one form, what are the constant residues? And for the cases which I listed above, the residues are all equal to zero. That's a computation you actually have to make. You cannot really say that a priori. The easiest way I know is that you can analyze the group of sections of this elliptic vibration and then actually just determine whether they have a residue around the singular locus or not. All right, so once you know that, once you have checked that, you now know that the AD and A transform exactly as the omega prime and omega as you go around the singularities. And what does that mean? Well, it means that now I can construct a very nice vector field. Let me just not mess up the notation. So, I told you before what the dp and dq is. You now know what the a and the ad is. And what I've written down here is a holomorphic vector field. And when I go around a singular fiber, you know how the ad and a transforms. And they transform exactly in a way that this stays well defined. So when I go around the singularity, the AD and A transform, the DP and the DQ transform, and they exactly transform in a way that the whole thing is invariant. And what does that mean? Well, it means that initially we had this a rank 2 vector bundle. So we had a rank 2 SL2Z vector bundle, which had some global holonomy when we go around the singular fibers. And now we have found a line bundle which maps into this rank 2 vector bundle. And if you actually compute the outer the connection applied to this vector field, you'll see that this is always the projection of the 1-0 part. So what does that mean? It means that this map of this line bundle into this rank 2 vector bundle is actually an immersion. And now we are almost in the situation of geometric quantization, that you can, you know, define an Hermitian metric on this line bundle such that its curvature is the symplectic, the holomorphic two-form we started with. That's what you always do in geometric quantization. You have a symplectic two-form, and now you want to quantize, but before you can quantize, you have to give this symplectic two-form a global meaning. And where does the global meaning come from? It comes from a line bundle, usually called the pre-quantum line bundle, such that the curvature of this pre-quantum line bundle is equal to this symplectic two-form. And now we already introduced the real sections of this bundle H. Now you can talk about the submanifold or sublattice of all the real section, so that when I evaluate the symplectic two form on this, they give me back an integer. So what I've just defined is I've defined the Bohr-Sommerfeld quantization condition. But the important thing is I can only do that after I give the symplectic two-form a global meaning. That's what geometric quantization is all about. All right, and I think I'm almost out of time. I actually don't quite know what to do. Let me define the central charge and then give you the main argument, how to compute the spectrum, and I hope I can do that within 10 minutes. So I'm not mad if you want to leave.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
So before you wrote down S as NM dp minus dp, did you say why, from the geometric point of view, NM and NE become integers?
No, there's no reason why they should.
Okay.
Because the point is, if you go around the singularity, they shift, and there's no global meaning to it, and there's no global meaning to what is an integer, because you can just rescale the form, you know, whatever you like, but only after you give the form a meaning as first term class of a line bundle, you can talk about quantization condition. And now it makes sense to ask that these NE and MN are integers, because we know exactly the quantization condition. All right, so, and then, so then the central charge, you can actually compute by just taking this real section and putting it into this symplectic two-form with this vector field zeta. Again, only when the residues are zero does this vector field zeta have a global meaning. All right, so now with that said, you can actually go through the argument of computing the BPS spectrum. And there's one thing which is important when you try to determine AD and A. And let me sketch that in the case NF equals 0. So there, let's imagine we have the U-plane. And you try to construct the solution AD and A. The important thing is AD and A are essentially hypergeometric functions. So if you want to introduce these solutions, you have to introduce branch cuts on the complex plane. And let me just pick the standard, what people usually pick as branch cuts. There's a branch cut in the definition of AD, which goes from minus infinity to u equals to minus 1. And in the definition of A, there are two branch cuts, one going from here to here, and one going from here to here. And whenever you cross a branch cut, you have to multiply such a solution, ADA, or a set of integers with the particular monodromy matrix to get the representation of the same state on the other side of the branch cut. All right, then Dave also introduced the line of marginal stability last time. That is simply the line where, so these are complex functions for each u, and you can ask where is the quotient of these two functions real, and it turns out that they are real along a curve which is diffeomorphic to a circle. It starts at this singularity, goes to here, and then goes back to u equal to minus 1. So that's the line of marginal stability. And if you actually ask what kind of values do the function take, it starts at minus 2 here, goes to 0, and then on the way back goes all the way to 2. Remember, the two don't have to agree here because there's a branch cut. All right, and now you see already the most important thing. So this piece here is called the strong coupling region. And the outer part here is called the weak coupling region. And you already see a fundamental difference. This weak coupling region is, you can always connect two points by a path which doesn't cross a branch cut. Whereas in the strong coupling region, if you want to connect one point here and one point here, you have to cross a branch cut. And this is the reason why the spectrum in the weak coupling region is different from the spectrum in the strong coupling region. It's exactly the fact that this one is disconnected by the branch cut and the other isn't. And there's one last argument which I want to tell you, and then I'll stop. Which is the following. Let's take a point in the U-plane with coordinate u and one here with coordinate minus u. Now, I told you there's an elliptic fibration. So over each point there's an elliptic fiber. Let's call this one eu and this one e minus u. I claim that these two are isomorphic as elliptic fibers. How do you check such a statement? Well, you have to compute something for this elliptic fiber, which is called the J invariant. And it's very simple to compute. You take this polynomial G2, cube it, and divide by delta. You can do that for the two. And for example, in the case NF equals to 0, you would see delta was equal to something like u squared minus 1, and g2 was, I don't remember the coefficients, I think u squared over 12 plus a number, which I forgot. But now you see, if I replace u by minus u, nothing happens to the J invariant, which means that these two elliptic curves are isomorphic. And then you can ask yourself, well, if I have the section omega prime omega, what are they mapped to under this isomorphism? You know, in general, it's not the trivial isomorphism. And then you can actually check that it's mapped to this thing. So you see, the very important thing here is this matrix in SL2Z is not element of the duality group. And where it actually comes from, it is a symmetry which comes from the Zn symmetry, which came from the broken U1R symmetry. This is where this element comes from. And now, how does this happen? Well, imagine you start with the state 0, 1 here. Now, let's identify these two elliptic curves. Then this state gets mapped to a state 2, 1. So you know, if this state, BPS state, is in the spectrum, so must be this one. Because now, if I'm in the weakly coupling region, I can just transport this one back to the original state I started with. And since the coefficient of the bases are constant, nothing can happen. So you see, by the existence of this D2 symmetry, you can conclude right away that all the states of the form 2n, so that's the electric charge, that's the magnetic charge, where n is in Z, have to be in the semi-classical spectrum by this argument. And now you also see why this argument is not working for the strongly coupling region anymore. Because I can do the first step, similar to what I did there. I have an elliptic curve here. I can identify this state with a state here. But then when I try to transport it back, I cross the branch cut. And when I cross the branch cut, I have to multiply with the monodromy matrix. So I think the machine tells me to stop. So that's actually what I want to say. Let me just tell you the important line of the argument. So the moduli space are rational elliptic surfaces given to you as elliptic vibrations over the U-plane. And then what you have to analyze is whether you can construct these functions AD and A. And then you have to analyze where the branch cuts are. And then the last ingredients to analyze the spectrum was to find this additional symmetry, which came from the broken U1R symmetry. And if you put these all together, you can analyze the spectrum. Okay, that's it. Sorry if I went over time.